You're listening to Practically Ideal.
Welcome to Practically Ideal, the podcast for idealists who like to keep it practical. I'm your host, Logan Bowe, podcasting from Chicago, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Bob, in Seattle. How you doing, Bob?
Hanging in there, doing great.
This week, we'll talk about finance reform, the New York Times' new proposed revenue model. In Bob's Tech Report, we'll cover Google and Apple, and the pop culture update, we'll talk about the Golden Globes. Let's rock. Bob, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I have a vacation coming up, so my doing great is partially influenced by that, I'd say.
Oh, nice. Close enough that you can look forward to it.
Yeah, but far enough away that I have like a shitload of work between now and then to finish.
And so that's next week. In fact, you're not going to be around to record the podcast next week. We should make this announcement. Breaking news, right?
That's right. Yeah, I leave on Tuesday and then I'm gone through the weekend when we normally record. So yeah, I'm off for a week.
That sounds awesome. And just to let our listeners know, we will have a special guest host that week. So tune in and you'll see who it'll be.
It's a surprise.
Did you say where you're going? I can't remember.
No, I haven't yet. We're going to Hawaii, Eva and I, my wife and I, and we haven't ever been, either of us. So it's kind of exciting. It's one of those kind of almost cliche things that married couples do in life, but we just have never done it.
Wow. I've never been to Hawaii either, but that's one of the places that everyone raves about. That should be fun.
Yeah, we're going to Oahu. Apparently, there are a lot of islands to choose from, or you can island hop, but we're kind of lazy. We're probably just going to stay on the main touristy one where Honolulu is and do all that stuff. But now that we're in Seattle, and we're as close as we're ever going to get to Hawaii without actually living there, if we like it, we may go again and check out some of the other stuff. So we'll see.
Cool. Sounds really exciting. I'm jealous.
You should be. I'll let you know how it is.
Awesome.
So what about you? Any new and exciting things happening for you this week?
Let me see. No. Not really. It's like a pretty boring, nose to the grindstone sort of week for me. Just trying to keep it real.
I didn't mean to shy you away from sharing your adventures, you know, as
yeah, if you weren't
to
going to Hawaii, then I might have something to share, but I didn't want to be upstaged.
That's right. You're probably like going to a movie or something, but it doesn't sound that exciting.
Not a whole lot. I mean, I had some people over. We watched the Jersey Shore finale, which was fun.
Oh boy, Jersey Shore.
Yeah, Jersey Shore. Maybe one of these days we'll get to it in the pop culture update. We went to, you know, a local microbrewery last night here in Chicago, the Goose Island Brew Pub, and that was actually pretty good. Had some good microbrew and some decent food. So, yeah, kind of a low-key week, but it was fun.
Sounds fun.
On Thursday, President Obama proposed giving bank regulators power to limit the size and activities of banks. There were two major parts of the proposal. First, commercial banks would no longer be able to engage in proprietary trading. Second, there would be caps on the amount of deposits a bank can hold, in effect limiting a bank's size. So far, details have been pretty vague, but there seems to be the intention to reverse some of the consolidation of different kinds of financial institutions in the late 90s, and generally to make banks smaller. So, how has Wall Street responded? With a massive sell-off, the largest three-day stock market loss in almost a year. So, it's been a while since I had my banking and finance class in college. You've studied this a little bit more recently in business school, I imagine, Bob.
Yeah.
But let's do our best to break it down for the people.
Love it.
Okay, so the strength of the proposed changes clearly comes in response to the financial crisis of late 2008 and the recession that followed it.
Right.
So how do these proposals try to address that?
Well, I think the one of them addresses it head on and the other one's more indirect. So there's the, just to recap, there's the limiting of the size, and then there's the don't use deposits for proprietary trading. That's the one I'm more inclined to support over the limit the size one, to be honest.
Just to give a little more background, yeah, we had Glass-Steagall in the 30s in the response to the Depression, and that basically said that the two types of banking, commercial banking and then investment banking, you know, you couldn't be both at once.
Right.
And then in the late 90s, a lot changed. So commercial banks and investment banks could combine in the same company.
Yes.
In 2008, for various reasons that we won't completely cover today, banks suffered huge losses from their own investments, and they saw those losses spill over and drag down the commercial banking side of their businesses, resulting in the collapse of some commercial banks.
Yeah.
And a drying up of credit. And so the proposal to separate the client-based trading from proprietary trading is an attempt to prevent that sort of thing from happening again.
Right.
And you're pretty sympathetic to that.
Yeah, it seems to make sense. I don't know why I should get upset about that.
And then the second one you're more skeptical of. Maybe I'll give the background on this one too first. When banks started failing in 2008, some were so big that many people worried that if they failed, it would be disastrous for the economy. In other words, they were too big to fail, as people are talking, supposedly. So the government bailed out several of the banks by lending them money. And this implicit guarantee that the government will bail out huge banks that get in over their heads is what economists call a moral hazard. And in this case, what's going on is that banks get all the profits, while the risk of losses is basically guaranteed by the government and shared by the taxpayer. So the limit on bank size is intended to reduce or eliminate this so-called too-big-to-fail moral hazard problem, right?
Right. Now, the reason I don't like it is because what's too big and what's too small? Well, nobody cares about what's too small, but where is the line going to be drawn, and what is medium size versus big size? And then the other thing is, doesn't, by definition, that first problem we're fixing kind of stem off this second problem to a certain degree? So why do we need the second attack on solving this problem if, for all intents and purposes, if they're not investment banks and more traditional banks at the same time? This feels very pendulum swinging like in traditional government form. Oh, some big thing happened that we hate. Let's overdo it and then slowly repeal it over time once people forget.
Okay, so you think the dividing the commercial from the proprietary trading is good, but the cap size is redundant and potentially more problematic.
Exactly. And I think if we do it, we'll end up repealing it later.
Okay, so, I mean, we talked about the ideals that we want to prevent what happened from happening again, and I'm totally on board with the desire to do that because it was pretty disastrous. But we got to talk to the practicalities, and you've talked a little bit about that already. Will it work? I guess that's what I really want to tackle now. The first one that you like, the dividing commercial from proprietary trading, it sounds like a great idea in theory. Here's my take. But it turns out to be very hard to distinguish commercial trading from proprietary trading, especially with some of the huge banks. You know, Goldman Sachs is kind of the figurehead for the whole Wall Street industry, and they're notorious for being almost like a black box of investments. You just give them money, and huge-ass profits come out the other end. No one really knows what's going on. If you talk to the people at Goldman, they say, everything we do is for the purpose of benefiting our clients. So it turns out to be really hard to draw that line and really separate them, for one.
Yeah. Isn't that partly because you need a very specific kind of education to know how mixing and mashing of multiple securities and then spitting it out into some new other security that's traded with insurances, with other companies? I mean, it's complicated stuff that they're doing. And so you can't just understand it unless you get some education.
Well, I think that's probably really true. And that's one of the things that we have going against us, really. It's hard for us to be expert enough to really evaluate these things because we've had some classes, but we're not in the finance industry or haven't devoted a large amount of time to studying it.
Right.
But from what I've read from some people, a lot of things just really are in a gray area or could be in both categories. I do think, as far as the details we've been given, and it's pretty vague, it seems like it'd be hard to do, and it's very likely to cause a lot of loopholes to make the distinction meaningless, is what some people have said.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know enough about it. I'm skeptical of the skepticism, if that makes any sense, because I feel like there's probably some way we can reconcile and find a line somewhere that makes sense where the two can be separated. It's hard for me to believe that they're so intertwined that it's like they're practically the same thing. I don't even know why we talk about them as two things. We shouldn't even try. It seems like that's a little bit, there's a little bit of naysaying going on there.
Okay, fair enough. Now, the second one, you've already talked about this a little bit. Someone has to decide what the optimal bank size is, and that seems like a really hard thing to do. I mean, it could change from year to year. If you get that wrong, it could make the law have no effect, or it could really cripple the abilities of banks to be profitable. So you could do a lot of damage with that one, and it'd be hard to know if you're doing it right.
Yeah, and I just don't know what it has to do with the problem at hand. Like, let me try using an analogy or a metaphor. Let's say that there are 10 really big companies and they're run by really bad people, and there's no law that says you can't cheat and steal and do some other things, and they do all this bad stuff, and then these 10 companies are about to fail, and the economy depends heavily on these companies, at least to a certain extent, and they're about to fail, but then the government comes and bails them out, and then later it's like, you know, we should really make cheating and stealing and bad people, we should figure out a way to make it so that that doesn't happen again. And then they figure out some ways, and then on top of that, they say, and, you know, size is a problem too. We should really just shrink the size of everything. It just seems like, where did that come from? Why is that? It just seems one step removed that makes it less relevant. They were so big because they were doing two different things that they shouldn't be doing at the same time. They wouldn't be that big if we didn't have that as an option for them, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. You have a good point that they might be redundant.
Yeah, I don't know, but there's probably some other good reasons. Even if you could convince me in theory that limiting the size of banks is a good idea, that'd be in theory. And you've already mentioned in practice, it's like somebody has to make that decision, and it seems like it's going to be pretty tricky.
Now, one thing I do want to point out is one of the biggest problems I have with this whole thing. It's a reason that I'm a little bit skeptical, especially the timing of it. I feel like this is sort of a populist measure designed to whip up antagonism against banks, you know, Wall Street and Goldman Sachs in particular, which are profiting while a lot of the country is
suffering.
Right. You know, Obama even said in his remarks, if it's a fight Wall Street wants, it's a fight they'll get. You know, and maybe that's how politics works. You have to talk like that. But at the same time, that's not necessarily what I hoped for from a president who ran on the platform of changing politics. So I feel like there's some antagonism here, and that it's partly designed to show that we're punishing the banks for being profitable, or we're punishing them because we don't like the amount of bonuses they give, and it's based on the populist angst instead of necessarily the best policy.
Very good point, and it's hard to differentiate where populist angst stops and actual good legislation begins. And so, yeah, I could see how that could make you nervous. I don't know what to do about it other than, I don't know, because there are some things about what he's doing that seem like they need to be done, but when he does do the whole rah, 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 if they want to fight, they're going to get one, it's just like, now you're making it into one of those issues where I actually have to, like, read a ton before I understand it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we're talking my practically ideal advice, what I would suggest is, or what I would like to see, I guess, like you say, I don't have enough knowledge to evaluate or suggest specific policy changes on this. And I have to kind of trust the smart people that they are doing something that is a good thing to do. But I do wish there were a less antagonistic stance, as I talked about, and the acknowledgement that we don't have to be upset at profits per se. You know, profitable, healthy financial institutions are a very good thing for the country.
Yeah, even if they're big.
Yeah. So I wish the discussion were more about both minimizing the systemic risk and allowing responsible profits instead of acting like those two things are incompatible.
Right. I'm with you there.
So quickly, what do you think this will do to the finance industry? As I mentioned at the beginning, the stock market has gone down a lot in response to the proposal so far.
Yeah, I'm not sure because, I mean, it might set them back a little bit. When they can't do the two things at the same time, the proprietary trading and the commercial banking, that seems to have worked really well for them, but then it was all kind of a facade and came down as a house of cards. So I don't know really how well it did work for them. So it almost feels like a reality check, and the stock market's reflecting that, like, oh, the party's over and it's really going to be over, not just like the party, we went on a temporary break, but now we're back. I've heard it put in terms of like an economic reset more than a recovery. What I mean by that, or what they mean by that, whoever I heard that from, is that the economy is going to be at a new level and with a slower growth rate, and we're going to have to start over on some certain things, because the way things were with the financial sector being like it was, so much was inflated, and like I think it was somewhere around 40% of GDP was just like fluff money floating back and forth being repackaged. And if a lot of that is going to go away, then it will be reset, and we're going to have to realize that when you're talking physical products and actual value add services, not just all the changing of hands, the size is going to shrink a little bit, right?
Some of that probably is necessary and probably prudent, but I hope that someone is taking sort of a global or a open market, by which I mean realizing that the United States isn't just its own closed off market sort of perspective on this, because it will shrink Wall Street, it will make it less profitable, and that has some consequences, because a lot of people who work in New York in the financial industry, they might be able to get jobs in London or in Hong Kong or Shanghai or these other places where they might be able to make more profits, and so some talent may vanish. And also, when that talent goes away, that's a lot of lost tax revenue. You know, these billions in bonuses that keep getting talked about and attacked, these are people who are making a lot of money. So basically, you can pencil in 35% of those bonuses as tax revenue, which is good for the government, good for the cities that the financial industry is in. So those are some consequences of what may happen if the financial sector in the United States is shrunk a little bit.
Yeah, so is there any way to have our cake and eat it too, so that they don't shrink, but then they don't have this power where everything could shut down like it almost did in 2008? It'd be nice to have a middle ground, but it feels like each has a set of consequences that aren't necessarily positive.
You're right. You know, I guess to some extent, I have to cop out and say, I'm just not smart enough or have the right technical expertise to really say. And that goes back to the way it's being talked about as a fight or as punishment doesn't make me confident that the people who are making these policies are taking all those interests into view, and that's one of the things that worries me.
Yeah, me too.
Practically Ideal. Politics, technology, pop culture.
This week, New York Times announced it would be moving to a new revenue model next year, including pay for access for some articles. The plan is for a certain number of articles to be freely accessible every month by each individual reader, but after that number, online readers would have to pay for the additional access. Now, the problem of how to get paid for producing news in the internet age is a big one. Lots of periodicals are suffering or even folding. Before evaluating this latest attempted solution, let's back up and give a little context here, okay?
Okay.
First, let's talk newspapers in general. And I mean the good old-fashioned dead tree version newspapers. Let's zoom back 10, 15 years ago before the internet was, well, before the internet was the internet, basically. If you wanted to keep completely informed, there are a few must-read papers. And when I talk about completely informed, I'm talking about a hypothetical person who has the kind of job where they can sit around reading three newspapers a day. And that'd be like if you have your own talk show that's national or university professor or something like that.
Right.
But, I mean, you probably had the Wall Street Journal, which was and is the best place for financial news. We have the Washington Post, which is going to be the best place for political news and for anything going on in Washington. And then the third one is you have the New York Times, which I think has the best international reporting and also is kind of the arbiter of middle to upper class culture, at least as far as newspapers go.
Yeah, I think that's a good trifecta there. I've subscribed to two of the three at various points in my life and still read two of the three, not daily, but probably weekly.
So especially, you know, in the 90s, great way to keep pretty well informed. And even today, if you're reading those three newspapers, you're doing pretty well.
Right.
But if we fast forward to today, there are a lot of other options, and you don't have to pay necessarily for most of those options.
Right, and I don't subscribe to the two of the three that I was talking about earlier, but I still read them today, and that's just because of the internet.
And these papers actually have different web models, or I guess the Washington Post and the New York Times are pretty much the same as far as you don't pay for access, while the Wall Street Journal, some of their stuff is free and some you have to pay for, and that's how they're all trying to survive. I actually think, since we're talking about the New York Times specifically, the New York Times is doing a really great job as far as the reader experience. I feel like they do a great job just organizing their site, making it easy to read, and integrating new features and multimedia in a really good way. For example, I find lately if I want to stream something over the internet, some big political speech or something, the New York Times usually has a hookup where I can do it right there. And since I'm there so often anyway, like, oh, I'll just watch it on the New York Times site. Things like that. So as far as an internet news website, I feel like the New York Times is really fantastic as far as that goes.
I'd have to agree with you. I give it an A. I really like the New York Times layout. It's easy on the eyes. It makes sense. The formatting and the spacing between different areas and even the advertising doesn't bother me. Wall Street Journal is getting there, but they're more in the B-plus range for me.
Do you subscribe to the Wall Street Journal? I mean, do you pay for access?
No, actually, I stopped last year, and I'll tell you why. Yes, there's a paywall, but there's also an easy way to circumvent it. You just go to a search engine and Google or Bing or whatever the article title that you're interested in, and if you then get to the link from the search engine, most of the time it gives you the full article. So on the one...
Really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah. It's kind of this thing that on the one hand, if you go to the Wall Street Journal and you start browsing around and you can only get the first paragraph or two of any article, at first you're like, oh, that's frustrating. Maybe I should subscribe if I want to read this stuff. But then it's not that hard, and they're not that expensive. I mean, I should subscribe, I guess, but if all it takes is like, oh, this is one I actually want to read the whole thing, I just like Google it and then use the link from there and I get the full thing. It's kind of a weird thing.
Wow, okay. One of the things that's different now, there are so many sources of news and different ways to get to the news. You don't have to rely on the editors of a single paper to decide what news you're going to get. That was one of the services that the newspapers provided that was one of the reasons they were so important. And now, that's still valuable, but it's not as crucial as it once was.
Yeah, and along those same lines, I mean, in the old model, what are you going to have, three papers open on your desk and you're going to cross-reference how three different journalists take an approach on a particular topic? No, that's, in the old model, it was more fluid, or you'd read one paper a lot and then feel like you had a stance on something without necessarily checking out what the other two papers had, because like you were saying, unless you're in the field or have a job where you have that kind of time to read three papers, you tended to stick with your favorite source. Whereas nowadays, at least for me, it's changed completely, where I'm more interested in the topic than I am in the source. So when there's a hot topic out there, I end up reading three different takes on it rather than sticking with the time I have for the one paper that I already have open.
This is actually becoming a problem for newspapers, as I alluded to in the beginning.
Right.
So how are newspapers going to make money? That's really the question.
Yeah.
And this is the New York Times' latest attempt to do that.
Right, because online advertising is not as glamorous as we were all hoping. I mean, it's something, but it's hard to say if it's sustainable as the only source of revenue for these big papers that are paying quality journalists to write good stuff. I don't know. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the newspapers for wanting to find other ways to make money, because online advertising isn't as cracked up as we all think it is, maybe.
You're right. But there's a real tension going on here, because the Times hasn't always been completely free. It was just a few years ago that they finally made everything, including all their archives, free. And I haven't read anyone who's done real study of this, but as soon as they became all the way free, that's really when they started blossoming into being, you know, one of the heavy hitters in the whole entire internet. Because like you say, it is possible to get around the Wall Street Journal's paywall, but at the same time, that's like an extra step I have to go through, and I know if I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal and I don't pay for access, that I'm going to run into that. So basically, I don't use the Wall Street Journal as a primary source. If I get linked to an article, cool, I'm happy to read it, but I don't go there first.
Right, and that method I talked about is not widely known. It's actually not supposed to be known. It's supposed to be more fluid, like search engine users. The Wall Street Journal wants the Google juice and wants to get that traffic feeding to them. It's new eyeballs that might subscribe if they like what they see. They don't think that there are going to be people like me who are going to recognize the pattern and take advantage of it. And I don't think there are that many people who take advantage of it, but I think the internet folk are pretty savvy, and it's only going to be a matter of time. You can't really have a walled garden, but then an open door on one side that you hope nobody notices. I don't know.
So that may be a problem for them.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the point is that even if there is a way to circumvent it, I rely on that less.
Right.
And the New York Times has really benefited as far as eyeballs and readership in the last couple of years since it's been completely open. Because if you're a blogger and you have three different newspapers or blogs that you want to link to describing a story, and you find one from the New York Times, you're going to give that a lot of weight, and that'll be one of the first ones you consider linking to, just because it gives your own blog story credit and your readers credit. Like, oh, well, if it's in the New York Times, that's a good clue that it's a quality story. But as soon as you start having to pay and people use it less as their newspaper of first resort, then one thing that might happen is it might become like the Wall Street Journal, and oh, cool, I'm reading a Wall Street Journal story or a New York Times story, but I don't go here first anymore. So it's hard to get the best of both worlds. And the way the New York Times is trying to do that is saying that you get your first few free. I don't know if we know the number. They're still going to work this whole year on getting the details the way they want them. But so that is their answer to letting Google traffic or links come in, I guess. But for the people who do use it first, they hope that they're willing to pay a little bit of money for that.
So let's talk about their solution, because there's something fundamentally missing from this announcement that to me will make or break how this works. And what I'm referring to specifically is, do you need an account? Do you need to actually log into the New York Times for them to track how many you get for free in the beginning of the month before you start paying? Or are they going to do it by cookies or some other browser-enabled way that's not transparent, but that's behind the scenes, so that you don't have to have that extra step to log in for any content, even the free stuff. The reason I bring this up is because if they're going to track your consumption and your amount of freebies by an account login, and everybody who wants to read the New York Times has to first log in and create an online profile with them, then all the links from Twitter, all the links from Google, they're all going to be kind of half dead, because they're going to take you to a bridge page, or that's going to say, oh, before you can even get this free content, you need to log in. And it just seems like fundamentally that is going to be problematic for them. There's going to be a lot of people. It's the internet. You lose my attention from a link. You want me to create a profile or log in. Sure, I only have to do it once, but if I'm somebody who's never done it before and I always assumed I had that information, maybe I'll just go somewhere else for my information. That could be faster than creating a profile with you. But then on the other hand, if you do the internet browser-based sort of thing, well, I have multiple browsers on my computer. I have multiple computers. Do they really care? Like, I just don't know what solution they're going to pick. And it seems like, again, in theory, I think it's actually not a bad idea. Oh, and then the third thing, let me just say quickly, do you pay for that month of access? Or if you go over your limit for the month, is it like, okay, now subscribe for the year you've maxed out? Or I don't know, lots of unanswered questions.
Yeah, well, you're right. So we want to see how those play out. So what I want to ask you is, do you think that you could answer those questions for the New York Times, given the practically ideal solution here, to where they could find some way to get revenue from people directly, while at the same time not putting up enough extra barriers that they aren't going to be one of the first places people look when they're looking for a news story?
Yeah, I'm not in favor of having to have an account for your free content. I think that's an extra barrier that's going to hurt them more than it's going to help them. So I personally, my practically ideal approach, if you will, would be to offer 5 or 10 articles, probably closer to 10 would be great, that you get to without any sort of wall of any kind. It's just how it is today. And then after those 10 articles, it detects based on your browser, which means you could get 20 articles if you have 2 or 3 different browsers. But I don't think that's a big deal, because that's a small percentage of internet readers.
And it's kind of like the search engine workaround for the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and I think it's actually even less problematic. So yeah, you leave it, if you're the New York Times, you leave it open, you give out 10 free articles, it just tracks it on your internet usage and the date, or, you know, behind the scenes with cookies, the browser, at the browser level. And then on your 11th article, it says, hey, you've used up your freebies, here's your charge for unlimited access for the next 30 days or something. But it has to be a pretty cheap rate. If I have to pay $5 every once in a while, that's not a problem for me. But if it's more than that, or if they want me to sign up for a year, or if they want even a double-digit dollar value, $10 is a lot more than $5 psychologically. Yeah. I don't know. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. So your practically ideal answer to some of these questions that are as yet unanswered would be, you want it to be browser-based, and it needs to be cheap enough that you'd consider doing it, not like $15 or $20 for the month or something like that.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I just want to say that for me, I kind of struggle because right now, well, I don't know, because I actually am a pretty loyal New York Times website reader. And so I really like it. I would like to stay. So I might consider actually paying for access. But at the same time, I don't know how much it would take to get me to go off to other news sources, or just a completely different model, like going more to Google News or aggregators like Real Clear Politics or The Daily Beast or things like that as my first stop, instead of the New York Times as my first stop. But I think maybe what you've described is pretty close to roping me in and keeping me to stay, because I'm probably the person that they hope would feel like could spend a little money to support the Times, because I do get a lot of value and I read way more than 10 articles every month from the New York Times. So they might, if they do it just right, like you said, they could actually get some money from me that way.
Yeah, and for me, it's almost like a support. It's like, I don't want to say charity-based or like a telethon or something, but I feel like there's something fundamentally wrong with the subscription model. At least for me, psychologically, when I subscribe to a magazine or a newspaper, and then I keep getting this reoccurring access, but one month I'll read one thing, another month I'll read 10 things. My consumption rate is just all over the place. I just hate the feeling like I've subscribed to something, I should really read it. I want to read stuff because it's good and because I was drawn to it. And then if I need to pay for that based on my consumption, that's just a much better feeling to me in terms of supporting it over the like, well, it's all or nothing, you know. You either love this thing and you read it cover to cover, or you feel bad because you subscribe to it and you only read an article every once in a while out of it. And it's like, what? Like, give me something in the middle. And I think the internet is the answer to that. So paying for some of this is not a problem, in my opinion.
You know, that reminds me of something. I don't know if that, if we'll get really into it today, but I was reading Ben Kasnoka, who's a guy that I like to read. I read his blog sometimes. And he had an idea. What if you could aggregate, like, authors? You could pay a subscription just to get everything that, say, Fareed Zakaria, Malcolm Gladwell, Thomas Friedman, and two other people that you choose. You just get everything that they write. So you like pay for a subscription to authors and you get your own bundle.
I love it. I would do that in a heartbeat. I tell you right now, I'd pay for that. I'm already doing that for some of my favorite authors anyway, but the tools to do it are kludgy and it's not a sophisticated, streamlined way. It should be easier. And if that was a service that the news organizations could band together and charge for, I think it'd be pretty cool.
Bob's Tech Report.
All right, it's time for the Tech Report. What do you have for us, Bob?
Well, this week I thought we'd take a look at the love triangle that is Microsoft, Google, and Apple. Maybe it's not a love triangle. Maybe it's a hate triangle. Maybe it's a love-hate thing. Maybe it's neither. Somewhere in the middle. So the reason we're going to talk about this is because recently there have been rumors that Microsoft and Apple are in talks to have Bing, Microsoft's search engine, be the default search engine on the iPhone. Up until now it's been Google, but Microsoft, not surprisingly, with their big marketing push around Bing, is trying to get more support for their search engine in popular areas, and the iPhone is definitely one of those popular areas.
Yeah.
So when users use a search engine on a mobile phone, generally some money changes hands. So like if you're using Google on your iPhone and then you see an ad, because Google serves up ads on the phone as well, and you click on it, Apple gets a cut of that from Google. So Microsoft, in theory, according to these unnamed sources, is willing to pay more money than Google. Plus, dun dun dun, on the other side, we just have kind of a fundamental shift in the relationship between Apple and Google. In the past, they were really buddy-buddy, but in this last year, we've seen Eric Schmidt resign from the board of directors of Apple, which was just a sign that they're breaking apart as a nice, cute little family. And we also have the release of the Google phone, which is all-inclusive, the Nexus One hardware-software combination. We have Google releasing a new browser, which competes not just with Microsoft's browser, but with Apple's browser, the Safari. And we have Google wanting to get into an OS, Google Chrome OS, which Apple has their OS. This is nothing new for Microsoft working with Google or Microsoft working with Apple or competing with either of these companies. The new thing is that Apple and Google are realizing that as they mature and want to diversify what they do in the technology sphere, that they can no longer hold hands. So with that, I find it fascinating. I think it's actually about time. I'm excited to see Google and Apple compete more directly. I think up until now, it's been a little too tight for my liking, and I hope Bing gets on the iPhone. But I want to see how an iPhone user feels about that. So, Logan?
Well, that's a good question. I have some reaction to it that I'm concerned that it might be changing my default choice because I don't like that Apple's choosing for me. When it really, Apple is choosing for me by making Google the default choice. It just happens to be my default choice, so it doesn't feel like they're choosing for me. By all accounts, certainly by your account, Bing is a totally fine search engine.
Especially for what you do on your phone. I mean, it's not as good, in my opinion. Bing might fall short when you're doing like detailed research on a project, but if you're just checking movie show times or the restaurant down the street, Bing is actually a lot better than Google for a lot of those things.
So yeah, as far as how it would affect me, it'd probably not affect me much at all. But for some reason, it would feel a little bit more of an imposition, and that's just my take. But I say that as someone who is not an anti-Microsoft person. A lot of iPhone users, that kind of overlaps with the Mac crowd, and the Mac crowd, a lot of those people are big-time anti-Microsoft. So I feel a little bit of a reaction against it, but I'm sure a lot of people will feel a big reaction against it.
It's interesting you say that, though, because there's already precedent for this. Microsoft has a big department focused on releasing Microsoft Office for Apple computers. computers. Apple has its own solution. Microsoft has a solution. And Microsoft and Apple have been frenemies for years now. I know for Microsoft, it's a multi-million dollar business at least, developing and selling Microsoft Office for Apple users. So there is a big enough crowd out there. I just don't know if that Apple crowd is the same Apple iPhone crowd, but it seems like it's going to be less of an issue if we look at that precedent, unless for some reason the iPhone is in a totally different category.
I mean, you're right. I feel like a lot of Apple users feel like Office is a necessary evil. You know, it's a standard one. It has by far the most functionality, so you kind of have to get it even if you're an Apple user. But I feel like, just speaking from my own experience without looking at it systematically, that Apple users of Office are some of the most vocal complainers of Office.
Oh, really?
So it's like a necessary evil. But I could be wrong, I suppose. I just sort of get that vibe.
So they're the most vocal, but they have a product alternative that's by the same company that they're passionate about, but they still choose to be vocal about the one that's still slightly better, though, right? Because otherwise,
I think they feel like you kind of have to get Microsoft Office because it has the most functionality and it's the standard. But at the same time, they complain.
Interesting.
Again, speaking from the hip, I don't know that to be certain. Just my impression.
But with a phone, and if my argument holds true that the experience could potentially be better with being over Google, and so if we whittle it down to the core element of this is Microsoft serving something to an Apple customer. But then we ignore whether or not it's better or worse because, for all intents and purposes, it could be a little bit better. Are there really going to be that many people who are upset by it? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I imagine a lot of people will bitch and moan about it, but will it mean someone doesn't buy the iPhone? I doubt that.
Yeah, I very much doubt that. Oh, I can't buy this phone. It has Microsoft search engine on it.
Now, tell me this. That'll be the default, but can you go back and change it to Google if you want?
Yeah.
If they change? Could I change it to Bing now if I felt like it on my iPhone? I don't even know. I haven't tried to do that.
You know, I don't have an iPhone. I haven't used it. I know Bing has an app in the iPhone App Store, and in fact, it's very, very popular. An app approach is one way to do that. I haven't heard of a Google search app.
Well, there is one, but I mean, if you're in the Safari browser on the iPhone, and there's just like a little window you click on that search, and it's by default Google search. I guess what I'm wondering, and I guess I could whip out my phone right now and try to figure out how to change it, is if you can change it.
I bet you can.
So it's just changing the default.
Right. I think it's the default. It's not going to lock you out of going somewhere else or changing it back.
But if that's the case, then that allows people who do have a problem with it to change it if they feel like it.
Right.
I imagine it's not going to be a big deal at all.
Yeah, I mean, 95% of the world doesn't change defaults like that, but for the 5% who do, they're probably vocal for a reason, and if you give them that flexibility, it's really not going to affect things on the aggregate level for the deals happening behind the scenes to make it work.
Oh, this is interesting. I just whipped out my iPhone.
Okay.
In real-time research right here. I can change between Google and Yahoo. That's it.
Oh, wow. Okay, there we go. So Bing's not even listed, let alone the default.
That's right.
That actually is kind of disappointing because Google and Yahoo are not the only two search engines. So I don't know what right. Microsoft has to do to just be listed as a third option, but it seems like that should be pretty straightforward. But there you have it, real time and for the masses. There's no Bing as it is today, even as a choice.
So that'd be welcome to have Bing as a choice. And if you have the choice to go back, then I think that'd be just fine of Apple to do.
Okay, cool. So real quick, what are your thoughts on Apple and Google competing more and being more of frenemies than best buddies and being on each other's boards and that sort of thing? Does that mean much to you?
I have very mixed feelings about Google as a company right now anyway. Because on the one hand, they have their don't be evil side. But on the other hand, they have their, what I'm going to call their evil side. and I feel like people overlook some of the things they do that are questionable as far as strong-arming other players in the market. I mean, when Google started out with don't be evil, I mean, that was really code word for don't be Microsoft, right?
It felt that way.
And now they are doing things like just destroying their own markets, like Google Maps, just giving it for free. MapQuest has taken a huge hit just because Google Maps is so much easier to access. The whole GPS industry is probably going to take a hit. I don't know if their new Google Navigation is going to kill it, but...
Oh, it's a big deal, though, for them. Their stock's tanked. I mean, the world is watching and is kind of scared for these companies where Google subsidizes and does whatever they want because they're drastically looking for a new way to make money as they rake in the dough with the search stuff.
Yeah, they've been involved in putting books online. They've got their own interpretation of copyright law. And right or wrong, it's not the only interpretation. And certain publishers and authors disagree vehemently. But Google's like, fuck them. We're just going to push ahead with how we think it's going to be. So they do these things that are awfully questionable. At the same time, he's getting credit for being the good guys.
Which is kind of ironic, because if you think of Microsoft, who they're not, Microsoft is very much by the book, follow standard procedure. If a country like China wants stuff filtered, okay, we're going to do that. Right or wrong, in your opinion, Microsoft plays by whatever the rules are. If you want to change the rules, that's up to you, but companies play by them. Google kind of has this, like, don't be evil, so we're like above the law. I mean, that's probably taking it too far, but they have kind of that vibe, right?
Yeah. Well, in the 90s, I think Microsoft did some things that were perhaps shady. I don't know if shady is the right word, but I think they did use some of their weight to kill Netscape and to kill WordPerfect, for example.
Right. This is true.
Both of which I thought were superior products, but Microsoft, just with their size and vastness, was able to crush them. So they do have that reputation that they've never been able to shake.
They have tried. I feel like the Microsoft of the 90s and the Microsoft of the 2000s, especially second half of the 2000s, is very, very different. And so, but I guess companies historically, how do you get rid of what you did? I mean, a lot of time has to go by, I guess.
Right. So I think Google does a lot more questionable than they get credit for. I'm a little bit glad, actually, to see a little bit of distancing by Apple from them. They're kind of the new big boy in town who steps on toes. And I think that should be acknowledged, I guess. So I don't mind the power shifting, the balance of power shifting a little bit in the tech world among the top three tech companies.
Well, good. Yeah, I feel the same way. I think it's healthy. I think it makes sense. I actually have issues with all three companies in different ways, but I feel like a lot of that is bridled by the fact that there is healthy competition.
Update. So, Bob, did you watch the Golden Globes?
Sort of. I watched a little bit of the red carpet leading up to it, and, you know, Fashion Police or whatever. It's kind of a guilty pleasure. And then the opening scene and a bit of the beginning, and then I watched the closing. So,
cool.
I didn't watch the full 3 hours, but probably an hour.
So what did you think of Ricky Gervais as the host? I liked him a lot, but what did you think?
Well, I really liked him. I mean, he's funny because he can get away with it, I suppose, but his blatant self-promotion, while it's funny, it actually is going to do very well for him, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, well, I like him. Ricky Gervais is one of my very favorite comedians. In fact, it's probably him and Jon Stewart are my two favorite, and then everyone else is fighting for third place. I thought he did a really good job. Funny, I liked that he had beer in his hand. I guess that's kind of a Golden Globes trademark thing. Everyone's drinking. But what is funny, he had a lot of funny things. One of my favorites was when he introduced Colin Farrell. Did you see that?
No, what did he do?
I wish I had the exact quote in front of me. I should have tried to find it. But he said something like, I don't want to promote stereotypes about the Irish as being drunken and party boys or something like that. And by the way, I'm introducing to you Colin Farrell. He did it way funnier than I just said it, but I thought that was funny. And then Colin Farrell, when he came on, he said, you know, I heard that Ricky Gervais specifically asked to introduce me, and I thought, oh, balls. Anyway, I thought he had some funny jokes. He mentioned that, well, he implied in a jokey way that the Golden Globes were for sale, which I guess some people say that they really are.
I did see that, and I thought it was pretty funny. And he took some jabs at NBC, and kind of saying, like, oh, I probably won't be invited to do this again. And
that's right. And he probably won't after that.
And one joke that made me crack up was toward Kiefer Sutherland, where he's like, I'm going to butcher it, of course, but he said something to the effect of, Kiefer Sutherland, the guy who just beats people up and they just keep the camera rolling and they figure, like, ah, well, this will fit in perfectly.
Yeah, I really liked his introductions. I think he did a good job. It seems like people do talk about the Golden Globes being sort of a setup for sale. The marketing campaigns of the studios can kind of influence heavily who gets what awards. Do you know anything more about that? I've just heard rumors.
I mean, if you just look at these categories and some of the nominees and some of the awards, that's one thing I wanted to get to, is just how not like the Oscars it is, where they award really bad stuff. The Oscars, they at least try to award what seems like is the good stuff, whereas the Golden Globes, like anything goes, like total crap can get nominated and awarded. And to me, it's like, really? You picked that over this?
Like Avatar was the winner of Best Picture. Now, I didn't even see it, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't the Best Picture of the year. I don't know. What you did see it. What do you think?
Well, right. I should preface, because I just said like total crap and stuff like that. Avatar is not total crap. It's actually a pretty good movie. It's a fun blockbuster, popcorn, you know, great special effects, immersive environment, story's so-so, acting's okay.
But it's also the biggest grossing movie of the year, and it seems like no coincidence that that's the one that won.
Yeah, it feels like 2009's Lord of the Rings or whatever. And this is where the Oscars could break down for me, too. It could very well win, you know, Best Picture. I hope it doesn't, because if it does, then it just kind of nullifies what I just said, where I like to think of there being a distinction between the Golden Globes and the Oscars. But
right. And also the Best Musical or Comedy Movie category, I always feel like that's kind of a weird one. Like, The Hangover won, and
Hangover.
Wait, really? That deserves a Golden Globe for Best Anything? And Nine was nominated in that category. Now, Nine is a real guilty pleasure for me. A lot of things I liked about it. But as a movie, it was not a great movie. And so it just, yeah, that whole category seems a little bit like a crock of shit to me. I don't know.
Yeah, and It's Complicated was also nominated in that category, which was not that great of a movie. It was okay. It was a little long. It was fun to see Alec Baldwin. But it's just not an award-worthy movie at all. And the movie that was in that category, which should have won, in my opinion, was 500 Days of Summer.
Mm.
Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't, but I've heard good things.
Now, that's a really good movie. And I remember seeing it and thinking, like, this might not, you know, go very far Oscar-wise. It's kind of got a indie feel to it that I don't know if it's been recognized enough now that it could be in the Oscar pool. But it's just ironic that it might not even make the cut for the Oscars. But then it's in this category for the Golden Globes, and it's by far the best one, in my opinion, and it didn't win.
Now, one of the things I do like about the Golden Globes is they do TV, and I'm a huge TV fan. As you probably know, anyone who listens to this loved the TV. And they did pretty well on the TV categories. For example, John Lithgow in Dexter. Holy shit, he was amazing. So I'm glad he won. Toni Collette in The United States of Tara. Brilliant performance. That's what I think I mentioned last week, that great performance by Toni Collette. So-so show, but she was fantastic in that.
So what did you think of Michael C. Hall winning for Dexter over Bill Paxton for Big Love or John Hamm for Mad Men?
I was just remembering that category, and I watched, is like, wow, that's a category with a lot of fantastic performances.
Yeah.
Michael C. Hall is a fantastic actor. He's great in the role as Dexter. The one thing that hurts him a little bit, as far as my own impression, the show Dexter isn't as good quality as some of his other shows, but his performance is right up there. I really can't quibble with Michael C. Hall winning that. John Hamm could win it every year, and you could not complain one bit. I would have liked to see Bill Paxton win it for Big Love, just to sort of give that little credibility. Chloe Sevigny won, and that was another category, the best actress in a TV show that was, could have been a lot of people. Jane Lynch in Glee, I would have loved to see her win too, but Chloe Sevigny does an amazing Nikki in Big Love.
Yeah, I can agree there. I'm glad she won. And Mad Men won for Best Television Series Drama, so even if it didn't get Best Actor, I'm glad to see it win in that category, to be honest. It was up against Big Love and Dexter. And I feel like, I haven't watched Dexter, so I don't know, but between Big Love and Mad Men, I'm kind of glad Mad Men won, just because it just feels like Big Love should have won earlier. They didn't. Or maybe they did. Has Big Love won in this category in the past? I shouldn't say that without double-checking.
You know, I don't have a list in front of me. I don't think they have.
But Mad Men feels more relevant right now for winning than Big Love does. Big Love is starting to, I'm going to say it, it's might be past its prime, just a hair. It's still good, but I wish they would have won last year. And maybe they did, and we don't know. But
and Mad Men is in full effect. That's true.
Yes, exactly. So, I agree with that one, for sure.
Any other notable awards, you think?
Meryl Streep won for Julie and Julia.
Did you see that?
I didn't see it. It's in my Netflix queue. I'm probably going to see it in the next month or so. I just remember watching her speech, and she just seemed like such a nice, cheerful, upbeat sort of person. It was like a happy feeling watching her.
She's a great actress.
Accept the award. Yeah, and she's a great actress, so I only assume that she did a good job. I'm glad to see Colin Firth in A Single Man nominated for Best Actor. This is a category that I'm not ready to make any wide sweeping statements about, but I feel like it anyway. Jeff Bridges won for Crazy Heart. This is a movie that I don't think I'm going to see. I'll tell you why. It's the type of movie that feels so Oscar baity. Like Jeff Bridges playing an old drunken has-been recording guitarist or country singer or something. It seems like from the previews like he probably does a great job, but is it really that good of a movie? Is it really that good of a performance, especially compared to what Colin Firth did in A Single Man? It's hard for me to believe, but I haven't seen it, so that's why I probably shouldn't say too much about it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the thing about the Golden Globes. I feel like, even if they're not completely rigged, I feel like they're a lot more given to politically correct things or sentimental choices. There's just a reason they're not as credible as the Oscars, in my mind.
Right, another one would be Sandra Bullock winning for Best Actress. It's like...
Oh, brother, yeah.
Huh?
Another one I loved that I thought was totally deserved was Christoph Waltz winning Best Supporting Actor for Inglourious Bastards. He was terrific.
Haven't seen that. I have it here on Blu-ray. I want to watch it.
He's like this Nazi guy who's evil but charismatic at the same time. And fantastic performance. He totally deserved it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it because I'm excited for that movie. And I'm glad to hear that that award was going to the right person. Now, another category that was just ridiculous. I got to find it here. But I've already forgotten about it because it was so ridiculous. Sandra Bullock being nominated for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical for The Proposal. Did you see that movie?
No, I didn't. It was one that I really had no interest in.
I'm just going to say it. It was a romantic comedy that was, in comparison to like Oscar-type movies or award-type movies, it was total shit. Like, I don't even know why it's on this list. And Sandra Bullock's role in it, she was the exact same person she was in 2 Weeks Notice with Hugh Grant that she was in any movie where she's doing a quirky comedy hard to get girl. Like, there was nothing about it. It was just a flat movie that that's probably the most frustrating one to even have that be in a category. It feels like the Oscars would never do that.
Yeah, I agree. Up in the Air, Jason Reitman won for Best Screenplay.
Glad to see that. And that one got nominated for a bunch of stuff, but I think it won where it deserved. It seems like it got nominated for George Clooney for Best Actor and maybe for some other things that are like, yeah, sure, it was a good movie and George Clooney did fine, but I'm positive that there's going to be somebody who did better acting than him.
Yeah, I didn't mind Jason Reitman winning. I like Jason Reitman, thought it was a good screenplay. Also wouldn't have minded Quentin Tarantino winning in that category, though, either.
Oh, really? Did he write the screenplay for Inglourious Basterds?
I think so. Wasn't he nominated? I'm pretty sure he was nominated in that category, at least. So that's a good clue that he did. I think he writes most of his stuff, doesn't he?
I think you're right. I think he's kind of one of those, I don't know what to call it, but those guys in Hollywood that does everything, produces,
creates,
directs
every part of his movie, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. One last thing I wanted to mention was Up winning for animated film.
Uh-huh.
I was a little disappointed. I feel like Pixar, Disney is just kind of always going to win. When Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox, it was so good. Like, to me, it just was so much better than Up, and it didn't win. So we'll see what happens with the Oscars, because that's another category that goes across both awards shows. And it's also another category where there's generally not much to pick from. So I'm pretty sure both of those are going to be nominated again. So I'm really crossing my fingers that Fantastic Mr. Fox will win, but I just have this feeling that like the overall feel of Disney Pixar is like, oh, they can do no wrong. Whenever they do something, it has to be brilliant.
It's like they get the award even without having watched the movie.
Practically.
Thanks for listening. To comment on anything you heard today, visit elbow.com. That's LBEAUX.com, where you can download this and future episodes. Or send us an email at practicallyideal@elbow.com. You can also find us on iTunes. Practically Ideal is recorded and produced by Logan Rowe. The intro and outro music, and the music before the pop culture update, is by The Emergence. Check them out at myspace.com/onegreatc. The music before the first two segments and before Bob's Tech Report is by Charles Jiske. If you like what you've heard, you can find more from him at charlesjiske.com. charlesjiske.com. Links to both The Emergence and Charles Jiske are available on the website.